If you want to open yourself up, find your life's purpose, walk firmly into your destiny, and find out what life cycle you're in, then intuitive spiritual coach Dora Jones is what you need, and she's available to you. Dora Jones is a tremendous, universal, and metaphysical coach who specializes in soul integration. Take advantage of the benefit of this dedicated spiritual coach who helps keep us at the top of the game. She uses her spiritual skills, numerology, and astrology to support you in knowing your divine blueprint. Visit www.inspirationscoop.com and schedule your phone session, e-session, or reading today. You'll receive the following benefits by using Dora's unique abilities as spiritual life coach. Increase self-esteem and personal worth, make more enlightened decisions, and shown ways to effectively state goals and plan your agenda. You'll be given the tools to release people, places, and things that block you from receiving and achieving. Begin today by simply calling 602-314-6344 or visit www.inspirationscoop.com or email dorajones@inspirationscoop.com.
Greetings. This is Krishna Kaur, President of the International Association of Black Yoga Teachers, and you are listening to Inner Life Radio, the healing frequency.
Thank you.
And I'm your host, Sonia Barrett, broadcasting from Inner Light Radio and BBS Radio on Wednesday, July 30th, 2008, Matrix Time. Join me each Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time as Sovereign Mind explores the nature of the game players, and the strategies in place to hold you spellbound and distracted. Informed guests will bring insight to the silent side of corporations, spiritual concepts, science, and technology, and how they're all being used to influence your choices. We will explore concepts and ideas that will stretch human imagination and potential. And as always, we want you to participate by calling in at 310-928-7733, or you may email your questions to innerlightradio@yahoo.com. My guest today is Dirk Vanderpoel, author of Quest for Middle Earth. The author has discovered the secret of why Tolkien believed that royal blood, Sangreal, must be preserved, and why it was imperative that his character, Arwen and Aragorn, marry. Learn about the knowledge he possessed decades before publication of the bestsellers Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and The Da Vinci Code. Dirk Vanderpoel, in his new book, Quest for Middle Earth, has researched scientific, biblical, and historical texts to discover if J.R.R. Tolkien had secret knowledge of Earth's early history and if he based The Lord of the Rings on this knowledge. Find out why Tolkien, an Oxford University professor of Anglo-Saxon and English language, learned to speak Finnish fluently and why he studied Norse folktales that were thousands of years old. As a devout Roman Catholic, he believed in one God, so why did he imagine a setting and a cast of characters with this Middle Earth that had one main god and a pantheon of minor gods? Dirk is also the publisher of well-known UFO Digest, www.ufodigest.com, one of the Internet's oldest and most popular UFO and paranormal online magazines. Dirk also has had a 25-year career in publishing, working for the Toronto Star and Hamilton Spectator, as well as being the publisher of several travel and other magazines. Again, you are listening to Sovereign Mind, live on Inner Light Radio and BBS Radio on Wednesday, July 30th. Dirk Vanderpoel, welcome to Sovereign Mind, and I sure hope I pronounced your last name properly.
Good morning. It's very nice to be with you.
I tell you, it was really fascinating running into your book, because I knew that the series, that there was, you know, a lot of truth to it. However, I didn't stop to research it, and I'm sure a lot of people didn't. Well, most people, I'm sure, don't even realize that there, you know, there's a lot of history intertwined in that information. Dirk, I want to find out, had you read the book before the movie came out, and at what point were you prompted to explore the validity of the story? Was it after reading the book, or was it after seeing the movie?
Actually, when I was about 20, I think, or my late teens, I tried to read The Hobbit, the prequel to The Lord of the Rings, and I couldn't get through the first 50 pages. I found it very difficult to read. But I went and saw The Lord of the Rings, and I saw the first two chapters, I guess, at the movies. Mm-hmm. And after the second one, there was a year to go before The Return of the King would be released. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't wait. So I went out and bought the book in the next couple of days and read it, I think, from cover to cover in 2 days.
So you were able to read that one. What was the difference? Was it the writing?
Yes, I found it much more interesting, or either that or I matured a bit.
Probably.
And I didn't mind going through it.
Yeah.
I found it very entertaining, though.
Well, okay, I still haven't read them, and I've talked to other people who have, and they're more excited about the books than the movie, actually, and they didn't think that it was done justice. But would you tell
us? It was pretty
them,
good. There was a few changes, but it wasn't too bad.
But not too bad.
Yeah.
Would you tell us a little bit about Tolkien's background, perhaps, which brings significance to his writing of the Lord of the Rings, and give us a little bit of insight on that, because there are a lot of people obviously in the listening audience who weren't aware of your book, so to give an idea as to what was so significant about Tolkien's background that led you to dig into that as well.
Okay, actually I think you covered quite a bit of it with your opening. You mentioned that he was an Oxford professor. Was really big into teaching history and English literature. And one of the things most people don't know is he was quite a historian having to do with the Holy Grail and the quest for the Holy Grail. I found an obscure note, which I have in my book, which says he worked on one of the earliest versions in the early 20th century of finding out the true origin of the Grail. And basically the Holy Grail and the royal blood is basically the same thing.
Okay.
And so he had an interest in it from day one. And when you talk about Arwen and Aragorn getting married, and why they had to get married, and why they had to continue the bloodline, it all has to do with the quest for the Holy Grail.
Right. Okay. Well, I want to get into that a little bit further down. I want to go into that part. But I want to cover, the next thing I want to ask you is, now in The Lord of the Rings, referring to Middle Earth, now is it referring to Middle Earth in terms of Hollow Earth, or is this a different reference? Just want to be sure that everyone in the, we're all on the same page
sure.
with that. Because obviously, you know, the mainstream, most people don't even know that there's any such question about a Middle Earth.
It's actually Northern Europe.
Okay.
It's what they had in mind.
Okay. All right. When they were talking about Middle Earth, okay. All right. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, definitely wasn't England, and it wasn't New Zealand.
Pardon?
As in the movie. It wasn't England, and it wasn't New Zealand, like in the movie.
Okay. Now, you compared Frodo's quest involving the ring with the Grail mythology, which is what you basically just mentioned. So now, would you explain the strong connection between the two? Because you had just mentioned it, but I wanted to make sure that we clarified what Middle Earth was in reference to the Lord of the Rings.
Okay. I think the best place to start would probably be with the Holy Grail. And approximately 4000 BC, and this is what Tolkien references for the timing of his books and his story, is when something changed on Earth, I guess, and man became sentient. And depending if you're religious or whatever, that could be when God created Adam and Eve. Or it could be when some other outside influence altered our DNA. But at some point, we became sentient and smart and grew above the animals. And basically, the first man, as the Bible says, was Adam, or Adamu. And it was his royal bloodline. He was actually called the first priest king. And from him on to Noah, on to Abraham, right up to Jesus, right up to the European royal families today. Mm-hmm. They claim they can be able to trace this bloodline. And that's the same bloodline that Tolkien talks about in his books. And that's why, if you remember in the story, that the king, or the land had no king, it only had a manager, and that it was of utmost importance for Aragorn to marry, so that the bloodline would continue and that the land would have a king once again. But the amazing thing was the bloodline is only carried by the woman. So he had to marry into the royal bloodline, which was, in this case, Arwen. Because Arwen was the last elf princess. And if you look at Camelot, we got King Arthur, we got Guinevere, and the same bloodline continued, and when they separated and there was no child, the land withered, and thus began the quest for the Holy Grail. That's so complicated, but that's basically it.
Yeah, basically the gist of it. Yeah, and just so the audience is clear, what he's giving is not the historical facts according to whose definition of history, but anyway, that's what he's doing. He's taking that information and connecting that with the film itself. Now, you also mentioned that in the quest for Middle Earth, a family of gods that once existed, and you referred back to Sumerian transcripts, naming the king of all gods, Anu, his realm being the expanse of the heavens. You said that there is evidence that these gods actually lived. And of course, we've heard, you know, a lot of different takes on the history. But what evidence have you run into that pins down the existence of these gods, and what is their connection then, again, connecting that with the Lord of the Rings? What aspect of truth is shown in these stories?
Okay. In your audience would be familiar with probably the Book of Enoch, which is not part of the Bible, but it's one of the books that's recognized as being biblical in nature. And it talks about a group of angels it calls the Nephilim. And these Nephilim descended from heaven, apparently, and took on human wives, and thus created a species, if you want to call that, or a new breed of human, which was, it says in the Bible, they were called the demigods of history, which are like superheroes, like Samson, like Hercules.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty interesting. But if you take that back to the Sumerians, they call them the Anunnaki. And they as well say they descended from heaven and did the very same things. Took wives and started breeding children.
So you're saying, you're talking about the Anunnakis?
That's right.
Okay. So you said they called the Sumerians the Anunnakis. Is that what you just said?
That's correct.
Okay.
And the Anunnaki supposedly came from a planet called Nibiru.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you discount that, it still talks about a race of people or a race of gods that descended from heaven to the earth and created civilization, basically.
Now, I'm going to go back to that information that you just gave. I have some other questions around that, but I want to go into the evidence. What evidence have you discovered of the existence of elves, hobbits, dwarves? Because I know in the book you go into some of these historical digs or information that's come up on that.
Sure. Okay, if you want to refer to a book that Tolkien wrote, which isn't historical, but it gives us a basis anyway, it's called The Silmarillion,
mm-hmm.
and it explains how he created the people that he put in his that he put in the Middle Earth, and he said that their god created the elves first, and the elves they lived a long time. They were tall. They were very strong. They carried the royal blood, and if you refer that to the Sumerians, the Anunnaki also created a group of people when they intermarried with the human wives, which also created a species which were tall, strong, and lived a long time. And in English literature and in a few other European sources, you will find that these people were called elves
mm-hmm.
by the English. And that name still continues today. You have family names that incorporate elves. You have family names that incorporate dragons. And this goes back at least 2,000 years, if not 3,000 years. It's
so
quite a coincidence that they're connected like that.
Right.
One's fiction, one's historical.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, there's so many. Okay, I have several questions tied into disinformation with elves and hobbits and dwarves. I wanted to say, at what point did we move to the elves being, because every time we think of elves, we see them as very tiny, but you're saying that they were tall.
That's right.
And besides that, there's also the connection with the word, and I'm jumping ahead, El. Which,
yes.
You know, Elohim, you made that connection also
right.
in the book. So whichever one you want to address first, probably maybe at what point, you know, did we start seeing them as little? Was it after the whole DNA thing? Or
I think it was used in a different context completely. and it was just a reference to little people or mysterious people.
Mm-hmm.
And over the centuries, I just think that it became more like fairy-like, like a fairy tale, type of fairy.
Okay. The definition, they meant one thing about the people itself in general, not
right.
necessarily the physical appearance, and then that got converted is what you're saying.
That's right.
Okay. Okay. Now, I wanted to also ask you, I remember you said that you had taken a trip to Mexico back in 77, and I just thought this was interesting when you went to the Mayan ruins.
I was actually back there in January.
Pardon me?
I was actually back there in January.
Oh, really? To the
yep.
same place?
Yep.
Oh. Anything changed, or did you discover anything new, or?
What I discovered, yeah, I saw a lot of new ruins that they're uncovering. The city's twice as big as it was when I was originally there in the 70s. Unfortunately, because of tourism, I guess they roped off now the stairs, so you can't climb to the top of the pyramid, which was really something to do, because you could see for miles and see the extent of the city.
Now you
but right now, I guess, if you walked around it, it would take you an hour to see all the places, if not longer. Mm. Huge.
Now, you talked about, the Mayans, and I thought some of this was kind of interesting, because the Mayans are really big, really huge right now in terms of, you know, the whole New Age
2012 thing.
Right, the calendar. But then what you described in terms of the cultural practices and the rituals, there was a lot of atrocities that were involved in terms of how they, you know, they proceeded in
blood sacrifices.
Exactly.
Right.
But we don't really, I don't we don't really hear that, though, when people talk about the Mayans.
Well, it's one of the things that they're discovering more of, is pits full of bodies that the heads have been cut off and, you know, the bodies have been dismembered. And apparently in times of drought, famine, this was the only way the Mayan priests and kings thought they could appease the gods and perhaps change the weather to save their people. One of the interesting things about the Mayan cities, I guess, is usually a Mayan city lasted about 300 to 500 years, and then it would be abandoned and they'd build a new one. And this all had to do with basically drought.
Mm-hmm.
They'd run out of food for the area and then just abandon the city and move.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah, that we don't really hear that much about that. I think it's interesting how we, as human beings, sometimes just get very selective in terms of, you know, what angle we want to see of something, because, but it's, I think it's important that we look at the whole picture when we have the opportunity to do that, in order to have a better balance about our history and where we're going. And a lot of this becomes just, you know, one-sided. So I thought that was interesting that that you had included that information in the book as well.
Well, the Mayans also believed in a tall white god.
Mm.
Actually, most of the South Americans did, and Central Mexico.
Mm.
And these tied directly back into as being the elves.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And perhaps they came from Atlantis, if you want to go to that extent.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look around the world at the number of pyramid civilizations, they go everywhere now, from China to Egypt to places in Bosnia to Central and South America.
Right.
And there's even some in the States.
Mm. But that's interesting what you said with your belief in a tall white god, because I've watched, or we've all watched, that belief system anyway, intertwined throughout many religions. And not without the realization of the fact that these were beings who passed themselves off as gods simply because of their abilities. And I think that's really something, because we still see that level of ignorance today, because people are not they're not doing research. Well, they don't feel there's any need to do research because they so strongly believe what they believe.
Well, in South America, the common name, I guess, was, or term for the folks was Viracocha.
Mm-hmm. And, that was the common name, you said?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they referred to this god as.
Mm-hmm.
And he would travel around with 30 to 40 other white people as well. It's just, it's quite bizarre, all right. And I don't know if you want to tie that into the Bible, but there's references to Jesus going to India as well with disciples, so
mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's connected or it isn't. It's just one of these weird things in history that
a lot of
can't
parallels.
Really put a label on, things happen.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you, we're going to go back to the EL, the L, in terms of
okay.
Elohim, but I want to first also, because this is going to lead up to it, you talked about the Anunnaki, the terrible eye, and then you compared it to the Ark of the Covenant. And so I wanted to ask you, what else do you know in terms of your research, the Ark, and exactly what was the Anunnaki's terrible eye? And this is kind of a lengthy question. And then you mentioned these eye idols. Found at Tel Brak, found in where is that? Northwestern Mesopotamia. And then you went further into comparing the eye on the dollar bills, the Anunnaki terrible eye. So you kind of...
Well, the Anunnaki terrible eye supposedly was a device that I think it was either Enki or Enlil, one of the sons of Anu, had, that he could actually see what you're doing in another city and follow you around. And
that sounds like right now.
Yes, it does. Sounds like the New World Order, right?
Exactly.
And that ties into the dollar bill. But the technology, if believed, was quite advanced. There's a book for your listeners to get if they're really interested in this subject, and it's called The Lost Book of Enki, and it's written by Zacharias Sitchin.
Mm-hmm.
And it explains life on Earth from one of the gods' points of view. They kind of get him, and I think it's a way to try to get him off the hook for all the things that went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting on what he describes is happening and how they created the world and everything else. But
so basically,
it's pretty good.
Basically. Okay, just to backtrack, so it's very clear. Anu, now we're talking in relationship to
the Samaria.
Right.
That's right, Anunnaki.
Right. And now the origin of the concept of the eye, all of this is so, it's such a big mush of information that at sometimes you're going, okay, where do I start? Okay, so we deal with the all-seeing eye, and we've seen it as so many different things or represented or described as so many different things. But then you're going back and you're saying the Anunnakis, this was more technology-based.
Right.
Right. This
was it wasn't so much magic as it was in The Lord of the Rings.
Well, you know,
if you remember.
And this is what most of everything is anyway. It's some sort of high-level technology, I think, that they were able to pass off to those that didn't know any better as magic. So then we got confused between magic and technology. Well, are they one and the same to some degree?
Yeah, magic is just science we can't understand today.
Exactly, basically.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, so we can actually see how easy it was then for these beings that were on the planet that didn't have a clue or were not that kind of savvy to have taken these other beings in and accepted them as some sort of god. And then to see how it still follows through today, it just amazes me. I feel like we haven't really grown much. It's still incorporated in different ways into a lot of these movements today.
That's true. And as your audience might relate back to, we're talking about the terrible eye because of the Eye of Sauron in The Lord of the Rings,
mm-hmm.
which
right.
followed the heroes all through the movie and in all the stories. But there was also the mirror of Galadriel, which was one of the elves had for seeing into the future and for seeing across the way as well, thousands of miles away. So this technology or science, whatever we're going to call it, or magic, was available to the elves as well as the Sauron.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So I think these were just were advanced beings to some degree.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They were technology savvy. And also, I remember you had said that they were able to use it to communicate between gods, between each
right.
other. I mean, that was perhaps like their cell phone to some degree.
One of the things we haven't talked about yet is the tie-in to The Lord of the Rings, I guess, to Norse mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, if you want to take a look at another book, which is called The Ring of the Nibelungs, you'll see that it relates almost exactly the same as The Return or The Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
When they talk about elves, they talk about the rings. They talk about hobbits or little people. They talk about princes and princesses and gods and magic swords and everything else, and dragons. So the two books are very similar in nature. And I think they're both inspired by earlier Finnish myths and stories.
Yeah, no, that's definitely an interesting comparison, and how he was able to weave, of so much of history, that unknown history anyway, to mainstream into that movie, into his writings, I should say. You stated that the first battle with gods and men fighting side by side was in Upper Egypt in the year 363. What can you tell us about that?
Well, basically what I read and put in the book, these, I guess you would call them, for lack of a better name, mercenaries, were trained by the god to fight alongside men. And when they were, I guess, ready or graduate, whatever, they were eventually used by the pharaoh in a battle, and they won the day, and they were rewarded. And I think that goes back to the Anunnaki again, into they created mankind for a certain purpose, and at that purpose at that time was to perhaps mine gold or something else, but in this case it was to train them as mercenaries, as soldiers, to fight on the side of the pharaoh. One of the things we haven't really got to yet, I don't know, it's probably on your list later on, mm-hmm. is the actual ring.
Mm-hmm.
The ring in the story.
I was going to ask that question, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay. The original Anunnaki had a council. And Anu was the head of the council, and there was 10 basically counselors.
And how many counselors? I'm sorry, how many?
10.
Okay.
I think it was 10 or 12. I can't recall offhand. But each one was given a ring. But the master ring, the all-encompassing ring, was worn by the king.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that each of the kings under him were bound to him by wearing that ring. And that idea was being transported or used directly in The Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So he didn't make that up. He got that from somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Interesting, though, because, again, we see how all of these bits and pieces are still intertwined into what we call, modern life or modern-day civilization. Lots of the past still very much so intertwined in how we operate. You pointed out that the plural of El is Elohim, a term used to denote the gods, but there's still so much confusion, really, about that
God.
Word. Pardon me?
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're referring to the singular or the plural of the word.
Right, but there, lots of people who look at this as a singular essence, as an individual.
Right, and it actually means more than one.
Interesting.
Yeah, it means multiple gods.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting, because what that says to me also is whatever was set in place then, so many religions or beliefs then, for those who are believing that they're worshiping, that word always fascinates me, one god are still actually worshiping several gods because of the confusion of a lot of these words.
Right. It's exactly what they were taught.
Exactly.
One of the things I mentioned in the book is something called the Donation of Constantine,
mm-hmm.
or Constantine. Did you come across that chapter?
I don't remember. I don't remember seeing that.
This basically allowed the church at the time, the Roman church at the time, to strip kingship away from the royal families.
Mm-hmm.
It used a forged document to declare that only the church, because of permission from Constantine, directly from God, apparently, allowed them to not only create bishops, but to create whole future kings. And basically what they're trying to do is control the money of the entire world just based on religion.
Now,
and it changed and it's never gone back to that.
Now, since you mentioned that, would you also explain, because what we see today as a royal family or a kingship or queenship is completely different than what that was originally, because that was more, what is it, did you say, service onto humanity.
That's right, that the entire purpose. Yeah, kings, the purpose of a king was to convey messages from the gods directly to the people, but he was not to rule over people, he was supposed to serve the people of his country, or his area. And that's changed drastically. Now they're dictators, basically.
And even then, though, the messages that were coming in, that they were getting, weren't those the messages from the Anunnaki in terms of, from what you had said, they basically got tired of dealing with the squabbling and all of that of humanity. So they actually had brought about or structured this whole kingship in place.
That's right.
And so even then, you've got these race of beings, I mean, and obviously several, you can see why they would fight over who's going to get to be in charge of a dumbed-down group on a planet. But you really get to see that, though, in terms of how they were in charge of everybody, and they just implemented all these systems that we're brainwashed with today and trying to figure out, you know, where do we fit into all of this and you know, assume some sort of sovereignty over yourself.
Yeah, what's the grand design, if there is one, and everything else?
Yeah, and you mentioned the Anglo-Saxon word for angle. Was it E-N-G-E-L, which later became angel, which I also, in English, which I also thought that was an interesting one, too. I don't know if you have any more that you want to elaborate on, because people are really tied into all of these concepts, and it's like, well, who are we really talking about? Was this another creation by another group of beings that created another level of beings, you know, that we then started to recognize as angels, some sort of guardianship?
Do you know that one of the original words for a hobbit was hob?
Mm-hmm.
And that basically means a tunnel liver.
What does it mean?
It means a burrower.
Okay.
To burrow, to dig in the ground.
Mm-hmm, right.
Somebody who lives beneath the ground is a hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called a hob, is the old English. But if you look at the movies, that's exactly what they did. They lived in the side of hills.
Mm-hmm.
So all these things go back thousands of years. Talking about hobbits, they discovered hobbits, and it's in an island chain called the Flores in the South Pacific. And apparently these hobbits lived up to just a few hundred years ago or something. And there's been a big controversy as to, are they a new race? Are they like a leper colony, just a colony of, you know, misformed people? Or are they experimental or kids or something? And they've come to conclusion now that there actually was a race of people who were like under 4 feet tall and lived completely alone on the island, which is called Flores, F-O-L. R-E-S, so your listeners can look it up.
Hmm.
And now they come to the conclusion that they actually are a race. So if these little people manage to live there, what makes us so certain that myths and fairy tales from other countries around the world talking about little people or wee people are not true as well?
That's the... But here's what's interesting, Dirk, is that certain things, mainstream, will have a difficult time believing. They will just
toss it right out. But all of the other things that cause them to be subservient and dumbed down and you know, and relinquishing their power spiritually, are, it's easier for them to accept. I mean, that is how strong whatever the programming was then, that's how strongly embedded it is today. Because
right.
Some of the, you know, yet they can't believe in UFOs, but at the same time, most of what they believe are formed by the very forces that they don't think exist. It's just wild.
It's quite a coincidence, but you know what the Hobbit's main food source was?
What was that?
They hunted giant eagles.
Wow.
And they found their bones as well on the island.
Mm.
These were birds. They were, you know, didn't have 100-foot wingspans, but they had 12 to 15-foot wingspans. Very large, very large birds. And they're from the eagle family.
Wow. Well, that should serve them for a while if they weren't that big.
That's right.
Because the years.
But I think it's possible that when we're going back and talking about how we were created, how possibly our DNA was manipulated by God, by the Anunnaki, the Nephilim, take
right.
your pick. Might that not explain things like Bigfoot or mermaids
mm-hmm.
or giants or whatever, trolls, whatever you want to call it. Let's just say for a second that their main purpose of coming to Earth was to mine gold, for the sake of argument.
Right.
Okay, if you found a gold source and it was under the water, why wouldn't you create a being that was half fish, half human?
Well,
they could go and get the gold for you, go mine it underwater.
Absolutely. It makes sense because it really would be no different than us coming up with technology to simplify, things in our lives, situations that we, as human beings, can't get into. I mean, no different than they, you know, finally created underwater cameras and robotics to go out in space. I mean, it really is no different. I just, these beings just had a higher level of technology as a capability to.
Yeah, we're just kids in a. We're just kids in a play box right now, learning how to play with DNA.
Absolutely.
Imagine if you mastered it thousands of years ago.
Well, yeah, and that's what I think is happening right now, though, is this, and of course I'm jumping ahead again, but this genetic modification, GMO food, I mean, and of course people, which they're not really talking about that much, but the integration of DNA from different species is really no different than what was going on then. It's like they're practicing. So they're practicing subtly changing human DNA by doing that, because if you're combining DNA from two different species, you're going to change. You're definitely going to change whoever that, you know, gets interjected into.
That's right.
So, yeah, so I see that. Like when you were writing about that, I definitely see that similarity. And
a lot of people get the wrong idea about this book. They think that I wrote it to attack Tolkien, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Absolutely.
The whole purpose,
I didn't see that.
Yeah, whole purpose of me writing the book was to try to discover what might have existed on Earth prior to mankind being in charge of it.
Mm-hmm.
What came before man?
Absolutely.
And that's why I wrote it.
And I see that. It's a great book. I mean, I want to definitely encourage the audience to really pick up that book, to get a copy of it, because it also encourages you to dig a little bit deeper, and it starts to connect the dots on some of the things that you may have thought, or, you know, some of the pieces that you put together, and that's what I have seen with it, Quest for Middle Earth. Now, also before we run out of time, okay, you said the meaning of Anunnaki was heaven came to earth. For that reason, traditionally referred to as 11 bloodlines or the dynasty of the Shining One, which is probably what you were talking about before when you thought maybe we were 10.
Yes.
Okay,
the Shining Ones refer to the elves as well. They're called that.
Now, who were these other, if there was 11 bloodlines, was it the Sumerians or the Anunnaki? So what, 11 were the other references. Okay, I was trying to figure out who...
It was
who
just different these? Family lines. Different
okay.
family lines from
okay.
The planet Nibiru, ruling families.
Okay, so you're saying it's different family lines from that planet Nibiru?
That's right. Yes.
Okay.
That's what they say anyway.
Yeah, okay. And also you mentioned the Dogon tribe and their belief are as passed down from one to the other about the DNA experiment and that where you were mentioning I guess the part fish, but they came to recognize this or these entities as gods as well.
Yeah, I think basically what they're referring to as when our visitors from the past came, whoever they were, they probably landed in the water and came ashore dressed in aqua suits and some kind of underwater gear.
Mm-hmm.
And the Dogon people at the time really didn't have a lot of experience
right.
or life experiences basically, hadn't seen anything like this before, so thought they were probably part fish, part man.
Right, right.
And they referred to them as the Numu.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they actually taught them, according to what I've read, the same things the Anunnaki taught people on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, the Dogon actually came from an area very close to Sumer.
Mm-hmm.
Before they actually went to, it's around Timbuktu where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories are parallel in many ways.
Right, right. Which says that there has to be some validity to...
Yeah, there has to be some connection because the time in the past is the same. Geographically, they were located very close to each other. So I think it's, far more than just mere coincidence.
Right, absolutely. And then the DNA disaster, I guess they mentioned that it had to be corrected, and then they attempted to correct it, but which supposedly resulted in man's loss of immortality. And as you said, perhaps when man lost his immortality, and was cursed, was he cursed to die at that point? When he lost his immortality, was he cursed to die at that point? I think that was a question that you had raised, which I thought was really interesting, though. What do you want to elaborate? I mean, I write about this information, so that's the reason why I'm asking you just to elaborate, if you would, a little bit on your curiosity around that.
Okay, I think when we were made, there was two different ways we were made. Originally, I believe that the Anunnaki women mated with human males to create a line immediately so they could use them for slave labor.
Mm-hmm.
I think after a lot of trial and error, they produced workers that were adequate for what they needed, but they needed far more of them. So they basically mass-produced them by altering the DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And these were either the... the Numo who did this, or was Anunnaki, or God, whatever you want to say. But basically, there was no such thing as can't live forever, basically, for immortality. I think it's more reasonable to think that the Anunnaki came from a planet, which we called Nibiru, for the sake of argument, where the lifespan there was probably 200,000-300,000 years, which had to do more with the rotation of the planet than anything else.
Right.
And as they came to Earth, they didn't pass that on to us, or that eventually weeded out of us, so that our lifespan now is 100, well, it's supposed to be 120, But we haven't quite got there yet. But
well,
I think originally it was.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought that up. I was so glad to see that, because this is something that I write about, and this is something that I am now presenting to people, the understanding that is really the way it was supposed to be and not what we are today. And
one
so,
minute.
Yeah. So
yeah,
anyway.
Okay.
No, go ahead. We have about a minute.
Okay. The actual stories in the Bible about Abraham living to be 900 and some odd years old and others living to be to great age as well, these were, I think, byproducts of the original mating between
the Anunnakis and the...
The Anunnaki women and the men, and that's why they managed to live so long.
Now, I want to make sure, because we're really basically out of time, could you give your information real quickly for me, please, Dirk?
Sure.
Your website.
You can go to Quest for Middle Earth, and it's -earth.com, or you can go to UFODigest.com and look for Quest for Middle Earth, and it's available at Amazon.com, all major bookstores. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your show, and it's been a blast.
Thank you so much, Dirk. And I, as always, I have great guests, so I always want to have them back at some point. But I want to thank the listening audience as well. Hope you enjoyed today's show. And again, you can email me, Sonia, S-O-N-I-A-B-A-R-R, @yahoo.com. And you may visit the website for the radio show, www.sovereignmindradio.com. My other website, www.spiritinform.com. Again, thank you, and please join us next week, Wednesday, at 9 Pacific time. And my guest will be Stuart Swedlow, author of 13 Cubed, Case Studies in Mind Control and Programming. And remember that the power to be a sovereign mind, a free mind, lies within you. Join us.
Your name is your brother. You say that you're tired of me. Children dying every day. My name is nobody, but I can't wait to see your face inside my door. Your name is your brother. You say that you got me on a notebook, writing it down every day. Your name is your brother. I'll change it to don't need the bed of your soul. I live in the ghetto. You just come to visit me around election time. But someday I will move.